All right, so I want to zoom in on this second key event in world history that has to be considered when you're building the biblical creation model. And if you want to try to properly interpret the physical evidence in the universe, and that is the flood. So we ended with Adam and Eve getting evicted from the garden, and obviously life on the earth would be very different for humanity than it would have been in the garden. And Scripture is almost completely silent about the events over the next 1,600 years. Moses essentially pushes fast forward, and we fly through the centuries up to the flood. The lifespan of the patriarchs from Adam to Noah are given in chapter 5, and those Bible believers who believe in an old age of the earth as promoted by modern uniformitarian geology sometimes we'll try to squeeze gaps into these genealogies to accommodate an old earth. And in response to that, besides the fact that dating techniques are based on uniformitarian assumptions, which are easily shown to be terrible assumptions in geology when you look at the actual physical evidence, and besides the fact that squeezing time in when humans are already on the scene is not going to help with making the Bible fit with the geologic column. We could talk about that. But the way that Moses states these genealogies here leaves no room for gaps. Over and over throughout the chapter, he uses this formula. X lived A years and had Y, and then X lived B years, and the total life of X was A plus B. So with this formula, Moses nails down this chronology tightly and allows no gaps in this pre-flood period. So Genesis 5 provides one of the primary biblical evidences that the earth is relatively young and does not accommodate modern uniformitarian geology. Simple math shows that there were around 1,650 years from creation to the flood. In the New Testament, Jude 14 verifies that there aren't gaps by calling Enoch the seventh from Adam, which lines up with the Genesis 5 genealogies. Now, we can't know the exact number of years because of a few things, like, you know, do you go with the Hebrew text or the Samaritan Pentateuch or the Septuagint? Do we know that did Noah have Shem on Noah's birthday? And did Shem have Arphaxad on Shem's birthday? Well, if not, then there's a rounding of a few months there, and that's likely. And so there's going to be some rounding, but assuming the Hebrew text is correct in its transmission, then we can be confident that the span of time between creation and the flood was 1,656 years, give or take about 5 years. This is a chart showing the lifespans of each of the 10 patriarchs from Adam to the flood based on the Hebrew text. And so we have about 1,650 years from creation to the flood. Notice that Adam was actually alive to meet all of these patriarchs except for Noah, and Methuselah died the year of the flood. The average lifespan, not counting Enoch, who was taken by God, was 912 years. So how in the world do we explain lifespans like that? Well, it may have been an effect from several factors: the lingering effects of the tree of life, less genetic degeneration at this point, so the genome would have been created perfect by God and has since deteriorated significantly. We've accumulated a lot of genetic mutation and disease and sickness that gets passed on. And a major factor was likely the nature of the pre-flood world and how different that was compared to what it is today. And we'll talk about that a lot in this session. Peter describes that world as having perished, and the fossil record reveals characteristics of the pre-flood world that proves it to be much different than the earth today. Again, I talk about that a lot in this book. Not only did people live longer, but things apparently grew larger, from enormous reptiles to enormous plants, both of which the fossil record reveals. Reptiles and plants grew to be enormous in pre-flood years and shortly thereafter. Recall the enormous fruit still growing in Palestine a few centuries after the flood, when two Israelite men had to carry a cluster of grapes on a pole between them. Large reptiles of the pre-flood world, of course, were the dinosaurs like this Brachiosaurus on display at the British Natural History Museum. And I'm standing beside him down there for scale. Here's a plesiosaur. So a big marine reptile. Again, you can see me for scale there. Insects were huge as well. We have false evidence of dragonfly-like creatures with wingspans of over 2 feet, your Meganeura. And how about this one? These millipedes that were up to 7.5 feet long. I would run, or I would jump on the back of it and ride it. That'd be. Anyway, today we got 21% oxygen in the atmosphere, but there's evidence of much higher oxygen levels in the past, as high as 35% oxygen in the atmosphere, which would have helped promote health, life, longevity, and size. And what's more, besides plants and animals, we know humans of giant stature walked the earth and continued to for some time after the flood. We know that after the flood, they reached heights of at least 6 cubits in a span, or what scholars believe to be 9 feet 9 inches tall, which was Goliath. And then you had King Og that had an even bigger bed. So before the flood, humans may have been even capable of even greater height, and we'll talk about that in a later session. Other things you can draw from the text and the spirit of history, based on the genealogies of Genesis 5, you get a rough idea of how long people lived before the flood. You find out how much time there was from creation to the flood, and so with that information, you can get a rough estimate of how many people would have likely been on the earth by the flood based on certain reasonable assumptions. So if we assume that people lived 900 years on average and women continued having children for roughly the first half of their lives as they do today, keeping in mind that they may have been able to have kids much longer, 800 years instead of 450 years. If they started having children at the conservative age of 25, and we assume that people live long enough to see all of their grandchildren, then so they live 2 generations. So with those conservative assumptions in place, we see that there could have easily been 215 million people on the planet by the time of the flood, and likely many more. That's an extremely conservative estimate. Some commentators will estimate even higher. Genesis 4:26, the last verse of chapter 4, tells us that after Seth had Enosh, men began to call on the name of the Lord. Chapter 5 then gives the lineage of Seth and Enosh, the generations of individuals who were calling on the name of the Lord. But things gradually changed over the next 1600 years. The reason for the flood given in the text is that every intent or intention, the ESV has, of the thought of man's heart was only evil continually. The cause of that wicked state on the earth is given in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 6. The sons of God, apparently those good people that are listed immediately prior to this chapter, who were calling on the name of the Lord, following God. So remember that the chapter divisions weren't in the original text. That was added later by people for convenience. So the good people began to notice beauty and prioritize that in their marital decisions. The good people began marrying the daughters of men, the worldly people, based on their physical beauty rather than spiritual beauty. And let that be a warning, young people, about the qualities you prioritize in your dating and marital decisions. Verse 3, notice the phrase, "His day shall be 120 years, Genesis 6:3. Some take that to mean that God was setting a limit as to how long man would be able to live from then on. He wouldn't be able to live very long. You wouldn't be able to live 900 years anymore. There's going to be 120-year max. And that doesn't work for a few reasons. Number one, Albert Barnes, the commentator, made a good point that man in this verse is referring to the single race of man, not the plurality of individuals making up the human race. And so the 120 years would seem to be referring to the life of the whole race of man is going, there are the whole race of man is going to die in 120 years. Also, number two, man kept living beyond 120 years for centuries after that statement is made, according to the genealogies after the flood. Number three, it would be strange to arbitrarily select 120 years as the upper limit for life longevity and then deem that to be the punishment for wickedness. And number four, the whole point of this section is to show how God ultimately punished the world through the flood, not through that life maximum. And so the punishment being referred to with 120 years would seem to be related to the flood. So it makes more sense contextually to be saying, hey, man has gotten pretty bad. I'm not going to put up with it forever. My spirit won't strive with man forever, the text says. So I'm going to reach a breaking point here. I'm going to give you 120 years to get your life right. And so Noah, you better get to work. So incidentally, with that understanding, If you look closely at the text, you see that Noah is 500 when Shemham and Japheth are born, or at least when he begins to have them. They're not triplets. And then he's 600 when the flood comes. So that's not 120 years. And so from that, we gather that the statement here by God in verse 3 is made during the genealogies of Genesis 5 that are just before this verse. So God apparently made the decision to bring about the flood some 20 years before Noah has Shemham and Japheth. All right, God instructs Noah to build a boat, 300 by 50 by 30 cubits, and according to scholars, that would translate to a football field and a half long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet tall. And that's assuming an 18-inch cubit. It actually is more likely that it was 20 to 21 inches. But according to scholars, that would translate to a football field and a half long, 75 feet wide, and again, 45 feet tall. He's told to make it out of this unknown wood called gopher wood, put three levels in it, have rooms for the animals, cover it with pitch so it doesn't leak, put a door in the side of it. God tells him to install an opening. This is not exactly a window like we usually think of, but according to the underlying Hebrew, apparently an opening for light and possibly ventilation that might have gone around the top of the vessel and was a cubit in height. According to Genesis 8:13, a covering or awning of some sort is put over this opening as well, which was left until the end of this torrential rain period, and then Noah opens this window-like structure to see the state of things after that. God apparently brings the animals or sends them to Noah, the ones that he wants on the ark. Noah doesn't have to go hunt these down. So a male and female representative of the unclean kinds of animals, and according to chapter 7, seven representatives of the clean kinds of animals. That's probably seven individuals, not seven pairs, but there is some disagreement on that. So again, these are representatives of kinds, not species. These are animals from the earth, including birds, creeping things, which would have included various reptiles, insects, and worms in some cases possibly. Noah also brings food for his family and the animals, and then after loading up, God himself shuts the door and the fireworks begin. That brings you right up to the flood. So again, the works of the Lord are great, studied by all who have pleasure in them. You know, the flood is one of the greatest works the Lord ever did. And the world has forgotten about the significance of this event. And the more I study it, the more I am in shock over what God did in this event. The Bible tells us only a few details of the flood. It occurred 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. It was global in its extent. It covered everything. The fountains of the deep broke up and water came from above. The mountains rose, the valley sunk. It lasted essentially a year, and that's about it, and that's not a lot to work with. So when we look up from the Bible and start looking at the world around us and begin trying to study this great ancient work of the Lord, this key event in the history of mankind, and we start trying to understand the evidence and interpret it in light of that event, we ask the question, what can we learn further about what happened in the flood? Does the evidence fit with Scripture? Does the physical evidence fit? Some have argued that the flood could not have been global. There's just not enough water on the earth, they say. So they'll look at the earth today and say, hey, if the flood happened, where did the water go? Is it in the sky? No, there's not enough water in the sky to cover the earth. If you took all the water in the atmosphere and emptied it onto the earth, it would only cover the earth to a depth of about an inch. Is it frozen in the ice caps? No, that wouldn't do it either. That would only cover the earth to a depth of 230 feet. Is it within the crust? Well, that's a little more significant. There's an estimated 6 quintillion gallons of water in the earth's crust today. So if you pump all that back out onto the surface of the earth, it would be enough to cover the earth with 600 feet of water. So picture 2 football fields into the sky. That's just the water hidden in the crust. But notice all of this is pretty insignificant. We're talking roughly 1,000 feet total here. When you consider the height of the great mountains today, many of which are over 25,000 feet high. And so many people who consider numbers like these and still want to believe in the Bible will then reject a worldwide flood and argue that the flood had to be a local catastrophe, not a global one. But as we'll see, that argument simply can't be sustained in light of science or Scripture. The evidence points to a global catastrophe. All right, let's start with a depiction of this event, what modern creation scientists believe happened during the first few hours of the flood. So modern Christian science theorizes that much of the water in the flood came from the oceans and from below the earth, rather than the way we've kind of tended to always think about this, it being from the clouds above. But keep in mind that it's also incorrect to think of the flood as only involving water. This is a major geologic event. The earth was restructured. So the phrase, the fountains of the great deep were broken up, is significant. The great deep, generally referring to the depths of the ocean. We're talking about, apparently, the breakup of the ocean floor. Proverbs 3:20 mentions that as well, stating that the depths were broken up. So the flood is a major geologic event. And notice the text here says all the fountains of the great deep are broken up. So there's more than just one, and all of them are broken up. Again, this suggests the breakup of the ocean floor. The order of events mentioned is noteworthy to creation scientists. The fountains of the great deep are mentioned first as breaking up, and then the rain is mentioned. The one might have caused the other. So what exactly initiates this chain of events is unclear. Did God miraculously, directly initiate the eruption of the fountains of the great deep? Did he maybe use some external physical entity like a massive meteorite or multiple meteorites? And interestingly, there is substantial amount of physical evidence that suggests a lot of meteorites struck the earth during what we understand to be the flood layer, rock layers. So secular geologists today tell us that there are roughly 200 acknowledged meteorite craters on the earth today that are verified as being from meteorites. Lots of others that are claimed to be, but there are roughly 200 that they understand these are clearly meteorite craters. When you convert the dates that they give to those of those craters to the biblical time frame, you find that 57% of the confirmed meteorite impacts throughout the Earth's history struck during the single year of the flood. Another 23% of the confirmed meteorite impacts date to the period immediately following the flood, from the flood through the Ice Age and up to Abraham. 80% of all the known meteorite impacts occurred during the flood and during the following few centuries as the earth was finally ultimately calming down. So a lot of meteorite activity that seems to be associated with the flood event. So regardless, Christian geologists have tried to piece together what may have occurred after the flood began based on our understanding of geology today. So geologists have determined that the interior of the earth is comprised of a solid inner core, a liquid outer core, a mantle of predominantly solid rock, although the upper part does have some plasticity, and then you have the crust upon which we live. Now, looking at the surface, geologists have discovered that the surface of the earth is broken up into plates that move around very slowly today on the order of centimeters per year. And so the earth is like a big cracked egg, and the earth appears to be unique in that. We're the only known planet to have these plates. Well, creation geologists believe that the cracking of this egg, of the earth egg, may have occurred when the flood began. And there's actually several recent secular geology articles that have been published that suggest that plate tectonics may have been initiated by meteorite activity. So the model that describes the motion of the plates and the effects of that motion is called plate tectonics by secular geologists. Most geologic activity on the earth occurs along the margins of these plates as they move. So your earthquakes, your volcanoes, your mountain building, as these plates move relative to each other, we find that different things happen. Some transform, where they slide past one another. Some diverge, so they move apart. And then new material from the mantle comes up into the gap. And we see this at mid-ocean ridges, for example. Some converge, where they smash into each other. So if two continental plates converge, it forms mountains. And if a continental plate converges with an ocean plate, then the ocean plate will subduct. So the ocean plate goes under the continental plate, starts diving into the mantle, and volcanoes form as that happens. So mountain building is extremely slow today because the plates are moving so slowly. And so it would take eons at today's rates to form the mountains. So if mountain forming is happening today at such slow rates, then how can creationists explain that evidence? How can that be harmonized with Scripture? Well, let's think about plate tectonics and the movement of these plates that comprise the surface of the Earth. From the movement of these plates, geologists are able to extrapolate backwards, reversing their current trajectory, and get an idea of their location in the past. And so you've probably heard of the supercontinent Pangaea, or again, the supercontinent that is thought to have preceded that, Rodinia. So plate tectonic theory is able to explain why, when the trajectory of the continents is reversed, they converge and fit together like a big puzzle that we call Pangaea. So plate tectonic theory explains why, when you form Pangaea, there's matching rock layers that cross these continents. There's matching mountain belts that go across these continents that are now separated by oceans, but which fit together when the supercontinent is put back together. The Appalachian Mountains of the eastern U.S. become the Caledonian Mountains of northern Europe when you put this back together. Plate tectonics explains why there's matching fossil distributions across these puzzle pieces of the continents that are again now separated, and many other things. It has great explanatory power, but as usual, modern naturalistic thinking is based on bad assumptions, mainly uniformitarianism. It's the idea that whatever you see going on today geologically, it's always gone on in that same way. So all the rates you see occurring today of movement and erosion, you assume it's always been that way throughout time. Cataclysmic events, which we don't witness today, like the flood, are assumed never to have happened. Okay, so if the continents are moving today on centimeters per year as fast as your fingernails grow, it's assumed they must have always moved that slowly. And therefore, it must have taken eons for the continents to fit together like that. Well, again, we've seen the Bible is known to be inspired, so it's a true account of history. That means the flood happened, which means uniformitarianism is not the right way to see this. We've got to take into account global catastrophes in the past that has to be considered if it could have played a role in plate movement. So using the actual evidence from modern geology and plate tectonics, but without the hidden assumption of uniformitarianism, creation geologists have developed our own version of this, catastrophic plate tectonics, or CPT. So a young Earth creation geophysicist by the name of John Baumgartner laid the groundwork for this model back in the 90s. And when he developed a supercomputer program while he was at UCLA doing doctoral research in geophysics and space physics, the program called TERRA helps to model the dynamics of the Earth's interior. So based upon the predictions of the program that he made, other creation physicists and geologists joined him in developing catastrophic plate tectonics that describes what likely happened during the flood. So significantly paraphrasing this model, before the flood, the plates apparently did not exist. The continents were not separated as they are today. At the onset of the flood, the fountains of the great deep are broken up, Genesis 7:11. So the plates break apart. And keep in mind that the fountains of the deep there wouldn't necessarily be solely water, but could include magma from beneath the earth as well. So according to CPT, something causes the breakup of that cold, dense ocean floor, breaking it in several places, including breaking away the ocean plates from continental plates. So according to computer simulations, when the break at those boundaries between the continental plates and the oceanic plates occurs, there would have been what is called thermal runaway subduction of the sea floor. So instead of the creeping rate at which plates are moving into the mantle today, at the beginning of the flood, the sea floor would have been diving into the mantle rapidly. Well, in 1994, when this was being developed, creation scientists predicted, okay, if we're right about this, then the mantle was essentially overturned like a conveyor belt, and there should therefore be evidence of colder material still in the mantle, deep, like down at the base of the mantle, because this just happened a few thousand years ago. So there hasn't been enough time for all that subducted material to get recycled into the mantle and heated up. See, if uniformitarian plate tectonics is true, then this process today of how slow they're moving, it's always been extremely slow, and so there would have been plenty of time for any material that's going down, that's being subducted, to have heated up and then be recycled back into the mantle before it got very deep. So there shouldn't be enormous piles of colder ocean floor stuck down at the base of the mantle. Well, sure enough, technology got to the point where 3 years after that prediction, seismic images of the mantle's density structure verified the creationist prediction and showed that there's evidence of enormous piles of colder material in the mantle piled up under these subduction zones at the base of the mantle, apparently remnants of the pre-flood ocean crust that piled up there. So this rapid diving would have caused the plates to move quickly on the order of meters per second instead of centimeters per year. So in other words, it's not continental drift, it's continental sprint going on. So the supercontinent breaks up, starts moving apart rapidly. That causes the rapid formation of mountains along the convergent zones across the Earth as materials are piling up as plates dive in or smash into each other as diving is going on. And so you picture this conveyor belt motion with the cold crust of the ocean floor diving into the mantle, and then hot mantle material is coming up then in the ocean floor, replacing that material. New ocean floor is being made. So what happens when that extra hot magma hits the cold ocean water? What would it do? Well, just throw some water on a campfire and see what happens. It's going to cause steam jets, and all across all of the divergent zones, most of which, or many of which, are in the ocean. So this would have caused intense rain around the globe as these geysers, which stretch for hundreds of miles all over the Earth, are all erupting simultaneously, pumping water high up into the atmosphere, which would then come down from the heavens as rain. And then you've got added magma to the sea floor, which would displace water from the sea onto the land. So that hot material that's now replacing the colder moving material on the ocean floor would have been in an expanded state because it's less dense, because it's hotter, and therefore it's lighter. So in essence, the ocean floor is floating higher in the mantle during this period, which would push the sea floor up, they estimate, 3,500 feet or more. So as the sea floor is raised, water from the seas is being pushed onto the land, carrying with it many of the marine creatures, explaining why we find marine creatures all across the continents, even in the middle, the center of continents, way away from the coasts, far away from the ocean. We even find them on what are now high mountains. So water is coming in from the ocean as the sea level is rising, in addition to the water coming down from all this immense geysers. So tsunamis would have been smashing into the coasts, major tectonic activity going on the ocean floor, which is what's going to cause those tsunamis. And there's been some recent studies going on in creation conferences over the effects of those flood tsunamis and what they would have done. So most of the water from the flood is coming from the oceans through steam jets and from the sea level rising. And remember, while all that's going on, you also keep in mind the continued meteorite impacts that are occurring. I found a simulation of what some secular geologists believe about the land configurations of the continents and their movements in the past. And the configurations and movements may well be correct, although it's happening much faster than they think. And much of the land would have been underwater while this movement is occurring, especially after about 5 months into the flood. So from this simulation, I took all of the known meteorite impacts from the flood and found where they struck the Earth, and then added them to the simulation showing approximately when and where these meteorites would have struck during the flood. And we keep in mind that these are only the craters that have been discovered thus far, and obviously any meteorites that struck the ocean areas during the flood wouldn't leave craters so easily, which is why the verified meteorite craters are land craters. So in order to get a better idea of how many meteorites actually struck during the flood, you have to add quite a few more. So far, there's over 100 meteorite craters that have been found on land that correlate to the flood period, but 70% of the surface of the Earth is in the ocean. So if we take what we know about the land and extrapolate to the ocean, then we have to add a good 230 or more meteorite impacts during the flood. So we're talking 330 to 400 meteorites that are smashing into the Earth during the flood. So clearly meteorites are a significant part of what's going on. So let's look at Psalm 104. You covered it, the earth, with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. The mountains rose. The valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they might, that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. Well, in light of verse 9, this seems to be referring to the flood, not creation week. Otherwise, this passage was violated during the flood. But assuming this refers to the flood, it makes sense, because we would say that the high mountains are actually forming during the flood as these plates are smashing into each other at fast rates at these convergence and subduction zones. So due to the formation of the mountains during the flood, a boundary has been created where it is now impossible for there to be enough water to completely submerge the earth again, just like this passage indicates. So by the mountains rising and the valley sinking, a boundary was set for the water that it might not again cover the earth. So according to the text, the rain itself continues for 40 uninterrupted days and nights, but that wasn't the extent of the catastrophe. The waters apparently continued to rise for some time after that. According to CPT, that'd be due to the fountains of the deep continuing to disperse lava and possibly water from beneath the earth, displacing seas onto the land. So the rising waters eventually levels out and apparently begin to decrease on the 150th day. So notice that's 5 months from the beginning of the flood. We tend to think of the flood being pretty much over in 40 days. But it's clear that there are some animals that are not dead for weeks, because the dinosaurs are found high in the flood layers and we have their fossilized footprints from their, while they're running away from some kind of catastrophic activity. And so they're alive deep into the flood, maybe for weeks or even months. So the water ends up being 15 cubits above the what we assume would be the pre-flood higher elevation areas. Notice that during this catastrophic period, typical earth processes, seasons, day and night and so forth, are totally disrupted. After the flood, God promises in Genesis 8:22, He's not going to allow that to happen on a global scale again. So the disruption of the seas as well as day and night would be expected with this catastrophic plate tectonics we've been talking about. So the cloud cover from both water and volcanic aerosols would have stopped day and night, blocking out sunlight, and with it summer and much of the heat that we receive. Obviously, seed time and harvest would be affected while the earth is covered with water. So let's return to the question that we asked towards the beginning. Was the flood global? How could there be enough water to cover the earth, prevailing above the mountains by over 20 feet? Well, with the CPT model I've laid out here, you might already see the answer to that question now. So let's look at the science side first of all. Remember that CPT theory would say that the water came primarily from the seas, both in the form of rain from these enormous geysers and in the form of the sea level being raised due to the ocean floor being raised. So when we recall from Psalm 104 that your taller mountains are forming during the flood, and we recall that from CPT that the mountains are forming as the plates are converging and subducting, we realize that the pre-flood world would have been much flatter than it is today. So notice it wouldn't be nearly as hard to cover the land with water at that point, because the taller mountains aren't even around yet until deep into the flood. In fact, when the recession had begun is the point at which these mountains start beginning to get pretty high. So you got a picture of a much flatter earth, one with a lower elevation. Covering the highest points on the earth by day 40 wouldn't require anywhere near the amount of water that it would require today. Okay, so where did the water go then? Well, first of all, as the ocean floor is raised during the flood and the intense geyser activity is going on from the fountains of the deep, that activity would have dumped loads of sediment onto the continents, raising the level of the continents relative to pre-flood times. And plus, the mountains would have formed at all these convergence and subduction zones, raising the land in those areas even higher. So notice, without the water going anywhere, the continents are now higher in elevation, making them stick out of the water further than in pre-flood times. But then you have to consider other implications of CPT. So recall that as the ocean floor is diving down into the mantle, new material is coming up and replacing that in all of these divergent zones. And that material is hotter, which means it's less dense, which means it's higher in the mantle, it's in more of an expanded state. That raises the ocean floor. Well, that conveyor belt process would have eventually stopped. And then after the ocean floor especially gets totally replaced with new material, and so the steam jets would have stopped, and that new material on the ocean floor would then start cooling, become more dense again, and therefore start compressing and sitting lower in the mantle, which would effectively slowly lower the seafloor again. And so then all the water that's covering the land could recede back to the ocean from the same place it came from. So bottom line, there's no problem from science in explaining where the water from a global flood came from and where it went. Other evidences of a global flood, starting at the Cambrian explosion, so at the beginning of what we call the Paleozoic rock layers, this is the point where creationists believe the flood started. Starting at that point, you have worldwide sandstone beds that were laid down by some kind of major catastrophic worldwide event that involved a lot of water. Sandstone beds that go across our continent and then jump over to other continents. You can follow these across the U.S. and jump over the ocean, and they continue into Europe. These are not localized beds of sediment like you see higher in the rock layers that are formed after the flood. These are worldwide beds. They begin in the Cambrian explosion, and then similar worldwide beds continue on up through the geologic column to the point at which the flood is thought by many to end, just above your Mesozoic rock layers. And also, sedimentary rock is the dominant type of rock found throughout these worldwide layers. And sedimentary rock is understood to generally be formed due to water activity. When you move from science now and look at the Bible, we find that the Bible doesn't leave room for a local flood interpretation. So very quickly notice, if it was a local flood, then why build an ark over 100 years or so? Why not just leave the area? Why bring animals from all over the place if this is local, where you're bringing representatives of every living thing of all flesh? Why do that? I mean, God's actually the one that's sending these animals to Noah anyway. Why not just send them out of the area? How would the ark be able to stay afloat for several months if this is just a local flood? How could the biblical terminology describing the water as covering the high mountains that are under the whole heaven be describing a local flood? How could water even get high enough locally to cover what are now the mountains if the flood was just a local flood? You have to have a way to explain where the mountains even come from in the flood. How could the biblical terminology describing the water as covering these high mountains under the whole heaven be explained in addition to the whole purpose of God wiping man from the face of the whole earth? How could that be accomplished with a local flood? If the flood was local, then isn't it true that God lied when he promised never to again destroy the earth with a flood like that? Local floods happen all the time, but not global floods. Also, Peter used the universal destruction of the earth and the flood to describe what judgment day will be like. So if the flood wasn't universal, then logically judgment wouldn't be either. Also, why would the seasons have been affected by this if this is just a local flood? Apparently, seed time, harvest, winter, summer, day and night are all stopped during the flood. Doesn't sound like the effects of a local flood. Why did the dove find no resting place for the sole of her foot when it was sent out? So the Bible just doesn't leave room for a local flood interpretation. Either the Bible is right that there was a global flood, or it's not, and the Bible's wrong. And there's no reason to question the Bible's claim that there was a global flood scientifically. On the same day the waters began to decrease, the ark rests on the mountains of Ararat, that mountain range, and the waters continued to recede for another 4 months. And during that period of recession, we know that retreating floodwaters would have catastrophically eroded many of Earth's canyons, though not necessarily all of them. The Grand Canyon is viewed as possibly from the Ice Age. After 9 months, on the first day of the 10th month, Noah could see the tops of various mountains. After another 40 days, he sends out a raven and a dove, waits, and several events here that happen. And so the timeline, as given in the text, is based on the Jewish calendar, which reckons time based on a lunar year, so 354 days total. Based on the text, you've got about a year and 11 days that passes. And when you convert that from the lunar to the solar calendar, you find that from beginning to end, Noah and the other passengers left the ark after one solar year, exactly 365 days. Noah and his family, eight people, exit the ark, and from those eight people repopulated the entire earth. So genetically, we have a portion of Noah's blood and a portion of his wife in our blood, regardless of our ethnicity. Now, whether or not the wives of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth were also part of his family, you know, were they sisters or cousins, or were they actually further removed? That's uncertain. They could have been from other Sethite or even Cainite families, for all we know. If so, the portion of our genes that would be traced solely back to Noah, if they're all just family marrying, that amount would grow. And genetically, we would all be traced back to just Noah and his wife. But unless all eight survivors are in Noah's lineage directly, then it can't be said that all of our blood came from just those two people, Noah and his wife. So the passengers from the ark, of course, would have found a completely different earth from the one they experienced before the flood. Peter says that the world that then existed perished, and there's no doubt a lot more meaning to that than we typically ascribe to it. This chart gives the lifespans of the patriarchs as recorded in Genesis 5 and 11. Notice the approximate 900-year lifespan before the flood, with the exception of Enoch and Lamech. And then notice the gradual drop in lifespans after the flood. So the Genesis 11 genealogies, which pick up after the flood, aren't quite as clear-cut as the Genesis 5 genealogies. But this seems to provide some evidence for the fact that apparently something is significantly different about the earth after the flood has ended, likely due to environmental changes, radiation, and so forth. So size, health, life longevity begins to drop drastically, possibly in a proportional way to what was going on the earth as it's gradually calming down after the flood. As further evidence of the major change that apparently occurred, Genesis 9, verses 2 and 3 says that animals would begin to fear and dread humans, possibly indicating something different about the nature of animals. And then in verse 3, apparently linked with that statement about the animals, we have the first mention of God authorizing a carnivorous diet for humans, which would have certainly led, you would think, to animals fearing us a little bit more. So again, whether or not some humans were already eating meat before this is not known, but for sure, God authorizes it here. It's also unclear as to whether this is the point at which animals formally became carnivorous in a widespread way. Again, this isn't necessarily demanded by the text, and we have evidence of carnivorous behavior during the flood. Another example of how different the world was after the flood is your ice age, or your ice surge, or ice advance, depending on which creation scientist you talk to. We find a lot of evidence on the earth that a large portion of the earth was once covered with ice. In fact, 30% of the land, as opposed to about 10% today. We can observe glacier movement today, and we can see what happens as glaciers move. And from those observations, we can see that the glaciers of the north used to extend deep down into the northern hemisphere, into America and so forth. Parallel striations or scratches that are on rocks that extend over miles and miles of plains from glacier activity, from rocks and boulders that are in glaciers as they move. Faceted rocks that are worn flat from glacier movement, till and moraines that pile up around glaciers as they move. Secular geologists today believe there were multiple ice ages over millions of years, as many as 50. But there's lots of issues with the modern interpretation of the evidence for these ice ages. No single theory has been advanced that can explain all the evidence. Why, for example, were all of the animal extinctions only after the supposed last ice age, where you've got 167 entire genera of the larger mammals that disappear from the earth? Why are there all these what we call disharmonious associations, where you have warm area animals like hippos that are mixing with cold area animals like the woolly mammoths and reindeer? Why is there evidence of wet deserts, areas that are now desert, but clearly went through a period of being lush and wet? And of course, the biggest issue that uniformitarians have, there is no known mechanism to even begin a single ice age, much less multiple ice ages. So how do you get one started? Well, this is a place where, once again, the creation model has provided a solid answer to the problem, that shows problems with the uniformitarian mindset about this. In fact, the ice age would be predicted to follow the flood based on the CPT model, as I've showed you. It would be a necessary effect of the flood. The flood would have triggered the ice age. So modern creation science theorizes there weren't multiple ice ages. There was one single ice age. We call it more of an ice advance rather than an ice age, because we're just talking about a gradual buildup that only lasted about 700 years with a peak at about the 500-year mark. So creation scientists would say that all of the evidence that secular meteorologists are using to argue for ice ages over millions of years fits into a single major ice age that lasted for only a few hundred years after the flood. Now, what would be needed to begin an ice age? Well, you might be tempted to think, well, it just needs to be colder. You need your winters to be colder, where you got more snow going on. But that would actually have the opposite effect, because whenever it's colder, it's also drier. So there's less moisture. And that gets at the root of why secular meteorologists can't figure out how to initiate one of these ice ages from a naturalistic perspective. Three basic ingredients are needed. You need cooler summers so that there's less melting. You need more moisture, and you need persistence of those two characteristics, all three of which would have been effects of the flood. So according to CPT, the volcanic activity during and after the flood would have shot immense amounts of aerosols into the atmosphere, which would have blocked a lot of the solar radiation that would be coming from the sun, which would cool your summers. So that would have caused less melting during the summertime, so the ice wouldn't have done the period of melting during the summer. Instead, it would have basically stopped growing and then continued to advance annually in waves, so instead of that melting. So eventually that's going to cause more and more extinctions towards the end of this advance period, when the animal habitats are really being threatened after a few hundred years. So the pre-flood environment also would have been likely warmer, including the ocean. But then all the volcanic activity going on in the flood, that would have caused a lot of heat to be released into the oceans, raising the temperature of the ocean by several degrees. So what would be the result of that? Much more evaporation of the seawater during that period, leading to intense snowfall, especially away from the equator, since sun rays were halted by the aerosols and ash. And then the third ingredient you need is the persistence of that. We'd predicted that volcanic activity from the catastrophic plate tectonics activity continued for some time after the flood. The oceans would have continued providing significantly elevated evaporation for possibly centuries until the earth calmed down and things started moving towards an equilibrium state, at which time the ice would have started retreating back towards the poles. So towards the end of the primary melting period, catastrophic melting would be predicted to occur, with huge amounts of water forming lakes, even in areas that are now deserts, explaining the evidence for wet deserts. As the lakes grew from the melting, then many of those natural dams that were holding that water in these makeshift lakes would have breached, causing the rapid formation of many of the Earth's canyons in a very short amount of time. And this is acknowledged to occur when dams breach today. Secular geologists argue that the Lake Missoula flood was a flood from an ice age, we would say the ice age, that occurred due to the failure of one of these natural dams from a melted glacier. And it caused immense destruction, including a 50-mile-long trench from 1 to 6 miles in width, with walls up to 900 feet high carved out of solid rock. Geologists estimate that 10 cubic miles of basalt from that trench were eroded rapidly by the catastrophic flooding. Grand Canyon is believed to have been formed in that way during the Ice Age too, and I could talk a lot about that. We don't have time. So the creationist ice advance theory may or may not be true. Again, this is a theory, but it has great explanatory power where modern uniformitarian models fail to explain the evidence. It explains why you have a huge number of animal extinctions only occurring once. It's because there's only one ice age. It explains the disharmonious association of the animals, because you've got milder winters and cooler summers keeping all of the animals relatively mixed. The evidence for wet deserts is explained by glaciers. Animal dispersions from Asia over to America across the Bering Strait is explained because you've got more water that would have been in the form of ice and clouds, allowing access across the strait. Plus, ice bridges would have formed in various places. The rapid formation of post-flood canyons is explained. The thickness of the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica is explained. And of course, the biggest plus is we have a clear-cut trigger to initiate the ice advance that is predicted. All right, I've got more to do, and I don't have time to do it. So maybe somebody will ask questions that allow me to just continue this at that point. Very quickly, let me just say, while that's going on, humanity is dispersing, right? After Babel occurs, they're moving across the planet. And we're going to skip. Babel could have been as early as 100 years after the flood. And if we assume that it was at the time of Peleg, based on Genesis 10:25, and so this likely would have fallen during the period of the Ice Age. And so we could say something about languages there. Let me highlight one other thing here. Human fossils and archaeological artifacts don't appear in the flood or pre-flood layers. They were all apparently wiped out in the flood, and I could talk about that if somebody wants to question me about that in the Q&A. But archaeologists study the artifacts from post-flood and divide what we call early human history into three ages. Your Stone Age, which is characterized by where humans are more nomadic. The reason they're more nomadic is because they're dispersing after the flood. It's not that they're not intelligent, but they are moving around. They're not setting up civilizations. And that lasts up to roughly the time of Abraham, and then the Bronze Age is going to be Abraham to David, when people have actually started putting down roots and building civilizations, and then Iron Age being David onward. So again, we could say a lot more about that if we had time, but we will not. I do discuss all this again in the flooded book more thoroughly. So as we wrap up, let's consider once again the flood. You know, Jesus had called the attention of his audience back to the flood in Matthew 24. As the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. You know, it's important to study the works of the Lord like the flood. It is crucial that humanity not forget the significance of that event. The flood really is a physical depiction of what God thinks about sin. Whenever we see a beautiful high mountain, you know, it's really not appropriate to say, oh, isn't that so pretty? Isn't it neat that God made that for me? Once you understand what created that, it should cause us to realize that our God is a holy God that doesn't appreciate sin. And he will hurt people over this issue if we don't get clarity on the importance of getting out of sin and becoming holy in the way he tells us to. The flood is a reminder that judgment can always be right around the corner. And we don't like to hear that today, but it's the truth. And yet the humanity has forgotten the significance of that event. But it's also a reminder that those who, like Noah, obey God can be saved through water too and receive the benefits of God's grace. Once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah, the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. There's also an antitype which now saves us, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. All right, let's go ahead and take, a 5-minute break before we go ahead and move into the next section of this study. Thank you for your attention.